Treacheries of the Space Marines. The Master's Bidding by Matthew Farrar. Part 2. Drachmas! Boomed Chengrel, as his bodyguard lurched back into the shadows by his tank. Drachmas of the Word Bearers, your legion has written its history with distinction. I have no doubt that you have a magnificent tribute, a majestic tale, to bid for my prize. Speak, Drachmas, and stake your claim.
For a few moments, Drachmas sat still, staring down into the bowl of cinders on his lap, and listening to the imp on his shoulder, declaiming the liturgy of Vilemost blessing. Finally, he seemed to see something in the ashes that pleased him. He placed the bowl carefully on the flagstones and walked to the centre of the half-circle. His gargoyle lowered its head and dropped its voice to a whisper, but never stopped speaking as Drachmas raised his own voice over it.
Logar tells us, in the 8th chapter of the admonition to the Bellacrene Crusade, that they are contemptible who seek an abdication of the self in subjugation to the transcendent. Now you shall hear how I and my brothers gave exegesis to his words, through bold action, through spiritual strength, and through the war we brought to the world of Eikol Tertia. How wretched was the furthest world in the Eikol cluster when we came upon it! Tertia had been a world of humanity since ages before our memory, paying tribute to the Great Crusade and its self-proclaimed emperor. But the shadow of the Imperium waned over the millennia. The grip of the dead faith of the Aquila began to slip. Eikol became fickle. One of its worlds fell to the lure of the four-armed marauders heralding the High Fleets, and only then did the Imperium show a face in the system to stamp out the infection. But they won no love from Eikol by it, and before long, Eikol Tertia was in open secession to seek shelter in the fold of yet more Xenos, the ambitious and striving Tau, who seek not to expunge other races, but to subjugate and regiment them under the greater good in whose name they claim to rule. But Lorgar tells us in the Veragon Encyclical that the strong hand cannot be directed by the clouded eye. And as you shall see, the eyes of the Tau are clouded indeed. Their viceroys promised a just and firm rule of Eikol, rather than the capricious and neglectful Imperium. But having taken the reins at Eikol, the creatures could not hold them. The Tau did not understand the warp touch in the way that humans can. They cannot feel the currents of the Godsea and respond to it, can never share our relationship to the primal. And thus blind, they knew not how to govern once a new generation began to grow on the world they had freed for themselves to rule. The children grew. Their children grew. The number of psychers grew. And the Tau would not understand what was happening. They scoffed at the Imperial traditions as witch myths peddled by Imperial confessors to foment anger and weaken the flock for more effective control. And so the warp touch spilled out from Eikol Tertia. Lorgar tells us in the 64 primary meditations that the gifts of the Godsea must never slip the traces of understanding. And when we saw the fate of Eikol, we gave praise to the Primarch's words. Here was a world caught between two masters, slipping free of the Xenos leash, but not yet back beneath the shadow of the Aquila. A world ready for a deeper, grander, truly godly allegiance. When we overflew the broad land that rode high against the planet's polar circle, like a pauldron on a shoulder, we found the frost-dusted shingle plains crisscrossed with rail tracks and pocked with mass driver silos. When Eikol had been in its prime,
The Tau had loaded shells full of Icol silica sands and rich biocultures and blasted them into orbit for their freighters to snare and drag back to their own heartworlds. After the Tau quit the system, bands of humans came fleeing from the bloodshed further south and turned the stripped silo compartments into refuges. Some still held out, some were abandoned, some had become home to Psyker children and become charnel houses, or worse. Two of Icol's continents straddled the equator. The first was a jagged, dislocated thing split by two tectonic seams, knuckled with mountains and restless with earthquake and lava. The humans here were base creatures of no dignity, who scavenged the rubble of Tau-built cities. In the winters they formed great caravans, travelling to sell their salvage to the surviving cities along the temperate coast. The scavengers prized their Psyker children highly, and willingly took the risks of raising them in order to make them weapons against their rivals. The second equatorial continent was low and flat, and stippled with seas and forests, where survivors lived and warred. A belief had sprung up there that the Psyker resurgence had come upon the world because the Tau had fled it, not the reverse, and so they had turned the old Tau sand mining rigs in the shallow inland seas into holy places. Here they would congregate according to ceremonial calendars, ritually hang those they suspected of Psykerhood, and perform acts of worship to abandoned Tau artifacts, pleading for their old Xenos masters to return and deliver them. Between the Great Lakes, the rest of the old citizens had taken their loyalty in the other direction, hailing the emergent Psykers as their saviours, reaching back for old scraps of memory of the Imperial faith to weave fanciful stories of saints and angels around the mad and possessed creatures whom they made their kings and prophets. It was the last continent, and among its serried islands and basalt reefs, where madness had truly incarnated. Here was where the Tau had laid down their quarantine camps for what they thought was madness and rebellion, exiling here the first Psykers to rise among their subjects as they strove to stay ascendant. By the time we landed there, the black cliffs and lichen groves had become playgrounds to the warp-touched, at their maddest and most free. When we stepped from our lander, we were greeted by a flayed torso and head that walked towards us on spider legs made of lightning, calling our names. Behind it crawled a thing made of four human bodies that wriggled along on a tangle of limbs and turned the ground it passed over to bleeding flesh. But Lorgar tells us in the second book of Tractacus Inthropia that to some powers it is given to us to be pupils, to some we are destined to be soldiers, but to others we know ourselves to be their masters, and over some we must understand that we are stewards. So I had sermonized to my brothers before we landed, to resolve them upon our mission. We were here as stewards, as builders and marshals and generals, and the folk of Icol Tarsia, awoken to the grandeur of chaos, were to us as children now, as pupils given us to guide. We sought them out, these wild ones who ran in packs or covens or roamed alone. They were feral, even the potent ones, wild and untrained, and we contained them and brought them to heel, showed them the meaning and the glory of their natures. Others were insane or given over wholly to something that had entered them as their untrained gifts blazed into the immaterium. We found places where distance and dimension had been mauled and folded in the wake of some calamitous possession that had consumed its host entirely. We found stretches of land burned sterile by warp fire, or torn up as though by monstrous hands or claws, although we never found any possessed whose forms matched these marks. Some we broke to the lash, some we bound with wards and scriptures. Some could not be made subjects, and then, with prayers and absolutions, we broke the flesh vessel and let the pure essence dissipate back into the warp. Some we harnessed to occult engines or bound into metal beasts of war. And when that land was ours, we moved north again. On the continent of seas we came as both conquerors and liberators. We subjugated the tribes with might and with zeal and inspiration. Assembled in great throngs along the shores, they watched while we stormed the old Tau rigs and slaughtered their enemies there. After that, they did not trudge before us as serfs, but marched joyously in our train as acolytes, begging any word-bearer they saw to teach them, or bless them, or pray over them. For as Lorgar tells us in the four entreaties to Kaiash Began, it is the breaking of dead loyalties that leads to transfiguration and rapture. We put them to work rebuilding the rig cities as fortresses, temples, and armories. Then we moved on anew. We voyaged to the shore of the great fractured continent and its cities. No great hives here, but sprawls of violent slums, the compounds of vicarious and arrogant nobles, the towers or pits where the raw psychers would congregate and fight or brood. To each city we announced our presence, declared that we were there to teach them a more potent faith than the leprous lies of the Imperium or the bloodless witterings of the Tau's greater good. Some cities embraced us and saw us in to preach and teach. Some did not recognize us for what we were and fought, and we sent the smoke of their burning into the sky as a beacon to the faithful. We rode out into the volcanic plains at the end of the winter, and by the turning of the summer, every scavenger clan was mustered behind a word-bearer's banner, and their chieftains pledged to us. When the next winter in turn came, we did not allow them to flee to temperate coasts. No, now we made them prove themselves to us. They raised a chain of shrine cities across the heart of the continent, then mustered for war and raiding across the sea to the north, doing battle in the bitter winds and bringing Tarsia's final continent into our grip. We could make the people of Icol march for 24 hours without rest, fight like demons with autogun or blade, or simply their fingers and teeth, and send up a shouted sacrament to the four powers in beautiful unison from an assembly that might number 10 or 10,000. Every chieftain could recite the titles of all the works of Lorgar and repeat scripture on spiritual leadership, fealty, zeal, and the hatred of the Imperium. Every ordinary subject on Icol could bow down and say the correct blessings and oaths when a word-bearer passed them. And by now, every psyker had been bound over to service in the great congregation of chaos, or had laid down their life in disobedience. We had found Icol the home to a worthless rabble, and made of it a congregation befitting any temporal from Malerio to the palace of the Primarch himself. Now we remade this world. Every city was rebuilt around its shrine, and we put the forges on our own warhulk to work to run out what was needed. Weapons, war gear, everything from devotional icons to brands with which to etch the proverbs of Lorgar upon our own new soldier's flesh. For we knew what was coming. Our omen setters had seen an eagle's wings spread across the stars and been haunted by visions of kneeling before a shrine to the four ruins that remade itself into a golden throne amid screams and the crashing of hammers. We knew that the Imperium was on its way. And they broke. Broke, my brothers. The Aquila's claw broke upon the rock we had made. A flotilla of warships, two great transports of the Imperial Guard, a clarion craft bonded to the ecclesiarchal sisterhood, and they could not sway Arkel Tertia from our teachings. These soldiers disgorged onto the surface in their millions, sure of easy conquest, but we harried them on the frost plains. We savaged them with ambushes and raids as they tried to overthrow the temple forts beneath the volcanoes. We made them pay 100 lives for every lasbolt and siege shell they fired at the rig cities that yet stand in the inland seas. The sisterhood spread out with the Imperial vanguard to make Icol buckle once again to throne and eagle. But now our congregation showed us what they had learned. They marched with their own banners held high, the eightfold arrow and the icons of the four greatest behemoths of the God Sea. The Imperials shed blood on the frost, burned our tanks beneath the ash clouds, even felled brother bearers of the word in our fortresses. But they could not make our congregation doubt their loyalty. They could not sow treachery among our flock. The guard fought until our counterattacks rolled them back, exhausted them, and crushed them. The sisters preached and burned until Icoli turned on them in flames of rage and destroyed them. They even brought inquisitors, two learned old fools, with great retinues, whose boasts, we were told, were that they could loosen the hold of chaos on the most dedicated minds. And both their heads swung by their hair from the front of my land raider as we paraded in triumph down the length of the volcanic plains. All their learning and all their violence, and not a single word of treachery could they sow. Icol Tertia remains a bastion of the eight blessings of chaos, loyal to the true faith to this very day. This is what faith can achieve, Master Chengral. This is the power that worship brings. Does Lorgar not pay tribute to it in the Pentadict and the Book of Lorgar and the Codex de Barathea? And so in celebration of what blessings we may earn through worship, here do I present my offer. But say the word, and from my craft up above, so I shall bring you an endless scroll, warp-charged, that will hang in the air above you and present you with the words of any and every scripture of Lorgar, moulded to your thoughts and situation, for you to be enlightened and strengthened. With it, I offer 64 flesh prayers, the eyeless and limbless bodies of the enemies of chaos. Now, with their minds stripped and left only with the ability to howl out prayers and psalms to chaos. They are all strong. All will cry out their prayers many times before they perish. And before them, they recite every major supplication and blessing from our body of doctrines. Also do I pledge to you 4 orbital shrine spires, to be wrought by the finest artisans of my congregation. Each shall be a personal retreat for your worship and meditation, each dedicated to one of the 4 powers who are the chief manifestations of that ultimate and divine ruin to which we all owe fealty. They shall be consecrated in your presence and set in motion about this world, that you and your warband may always know that the gods of the warp watch over you. How say you, Chengral, Iron Warrior, do you accept our price?
Chengral's face had distorted in an expression that after a moment became recognizable as concentration. His eyes had drifted closed, and his toothless mouth worked. After a moment, he opened his eyes and spoke.
You speak with great care of your missionary efforts and the state of the world before you arrive there. But when you come to the meat and bone of the matter, Drachmas, to the iron of the matter, you leap over it with little care. Is all your story about preaching, about listening to this rabble say their lessons? Have you no pride in how you met the Imperial assault?
The war was magnificent, declared Drachmas in reply, as his little demon scuttled up behind him, clambered up his back, and resumed its perch on his shoulder, whispering all the while. But the war was proof of our work, not the work itself. I have spoken to you of the spreading and marshalling of faith, Master Chengral, the true faith that our primarchs and ancestors battled the Emperor himself to uphold. Is that not the great work, as Lorgar tells us?
It is not, Drachmas, snarled Chengral,
his tank creaking forward as he spoke.
It is not. The great work is not to prat off this verse and that psalm and these prayers and those books. Shake the dust off cultures from your feet, Drachmas, and remember yourself. Remember your legion and your legacy. Does the shaming of your Primarch mean nothing to you? Are you so soft-hearted that you set aside your grudge so easily? I set nothing aside, Drachmas. I do not value the scriptures and scrolls you offer me. They will not win you my prize, and your account, which could have had me hail you a true brother, does not earn my respect. You may be seated.
Drachmas turned to look at each of the other guests in turn, but none would give any word or any sign of their thoughts. The word-bearer walked to his seat, picked up his bowl of smouldering bone, and stared into the smoke from it as he stood with his back to Chengril's tank.
"I withdraw,"
declared Chengril, when it became apparent that Drachmas was not going to turn around.
"Emish Ae of the blood of Fulgrim, Crove, scion of Magnus, consider what you have heard from your brothers and resolve each of you to tell a tale worthy of your legion's names."
Once again, Chengril's tank backed away from the little assembly and stalked off, and after a few moments, the other four Chaos Space Marines made their impassive way back to their landing camps to let the night end and the next day of bidding begin.
"So neither of us, it appears," observed Drachmas to Hodir.
Once again, the two found themselves walking away from the meeting together, with Emish Ae loping rapidly ahead of them in his clinking glass cloak, and Crove, solitary and inscrutable, hanging behind.
"None of us at all," growled Hodir in reply.
"It seems to me that so-called Master Chengril has made up his mind that his prize will not change hands at all, whether or not he has done so consciously."
"Chengril's strength must be formidable to entitle him to such a prize, let alone to this demeanour," said Drachmas. Everything in his tone made the statement a question.
"To parade such a prize in front of armed visitors would require great confidence that one had such strength," Hodir replied.
The two walked on a little further, each turning to look at the terrain about them and back at Chengril's palace. Each examined the other's marching retinue. Each knew the other was doing the same. Each knew that the other was appraising their followers as potential opponents as well as potential allies. Neither bothered to comment on the fact. They came to a halt at the top of the little rise from which they could see their landing ziggurats and pavilions. Emish Ae was a dot, scrambling up his ziggurat steps to open the hatch of his cutter.
"The Lorgar's scriptures have much to say on being ready for the necessity to strike."
"Indeed," Drachmas chuckled. "I can think of over 100 passages."
"I thought so."
At that moment, Crove overtook them, moving up the road in haughty strides, but somehow seeming to glide along even faster than the movement of his legs warranted.
"Have you a bit ready, then, Lord Crove?"
asked Hodir, as it became clear the Thousand Sun was about to simply pass them by.
"A bid and an account, as have we all," Crove answered him. "We were discussing our host's humours," said Drachmas. "We have contingencies ready if matters go astray." "As have we all," said Crove again, and with a perfunctory salute with his staff, was on his way.
The other two Legion contingents parted a moment later and went their own ways.
"These reports I hear do not move me to admiration,"
Chengril declared to his sullen guests the following afternoon.
"Under the War Master's banner, we lance the hide of the false Imperium from Cadia to Calf and back again. How is it that the Legion send such little lost lambs to me now? Emish Ae of the Legion of Fulgrim, I know that you have special reason to desire what I offer. Come before me and prove it."
This day, Emish Ae had not come alone. Pinned to his flesh were two long cords of woven silk, And tethered by collars to these cords were two crippled and naked followers, twin brother and sister, both Amish Ai slaves of many years. Amish Ai had blinded the boy and deafened the girl, and then had cut off their arms at the shoulders. In this way they were always aware of one another, but unable to converse or embrace. Sometimes their master would allow them to sit together, clumsily trying to comfort each other, with their cut and scarred bodies unable to embrace, Amish Ai giggling and trilling with excitement over the misery he was inflicting. Unable to shape words with his mutilated tongue, Amish Ai would grunt and yelp and clash his distended fingers in a cacophony that he had carefully and brutally trained the boy to interpret. Now strutting in the centre of the meeting square, Amish Ai began to warble and clap. At each pause in his antics, the boy twin spoke, while the girl, unable to hear her brother's words, looked up at Chengul or around the chamber at the others.
"Amish Ai, whose words I speak, speaks his gratitude," said the master through the voice of his slave. "Amish Ai, whose will and instrument I am so pleased to be, speaks welcome and companionship to his fellow devotees and servants of the powers of the wellspring."
Hodair and Crove exchanged a look at that, and Chengral's expression turned stony. But Drachmas nodded and stirred the smoking ashes in his bowl.
"Amish Ai presents himself for your admiration as the brave, the elegant, the exquisite master of the train of Slaanesh. Amish Ai shall present his offering and his account, certain that both shall delight, even as our service to the great ruin delights us all. Amish Ai now speaks to his fellow masters direct, and bids my voice to speak just as his own, as he recounts a tale of his deeds."
In such a fashion, laced with both vanity and strangeness, did Amish Ai begin his tale.
"It is evident that there is no higher calling than of delight," when the boy twin's words. "And there is no higher delight than subjugation at the feet of Slaanesh, who bestows riches of excess that this cold and rule-bound universe cannot match. What better account to present than that of a liberation from drudgery and the elevation into rapture? Is this not the most perfect refinement of the concept of victory? We all know, we of the nine legions, of the one legion among us who have turned their back on delight, who have not only allowed the life of the senses to slip through their fingers, but who have opened their hand and let it fall into the dust." Amish Ai's gestures aped his words, slowly uncurling the six joints in each of his six fingers. "You, Crove, subject of the great conspirator, may vouch for this. These are your enemies, as they are mine, the devotees of Nurgle, and here is what I won from them. My court and I were dancing our celebration of ruin of the maiden world Ithruian, when word came to me that Typhus, that bitter little soul, was mustering his plague fleet for some great work. The news pricked my wits, woke me to possibilities. What a conquest, what a victory to lay at the feet of the ecstatic prince. What new doors may be opened to my consciousness in reward. My sweet demon consorts slid their barbs into my senses and cast visions into my eyes and words into my ears. They showed me Typhus's contention with some mighty imperial preacher, who had led a great host of his faithful to claim a world whose faith was already claimed elsewhere. They showed me Typhus raising his tattered banner in the fray, the confrontation that drove the imperial invaders back, and the tiny clutch of eggs under the preacher's skin, undetected among the stingwelts from Typhus's unhollowed destroyer swarm, incubating in him, even as their parent swarm lived in Typhus's own flesh. Soon the upstart swarm had made a hollow wreck of the upstart missionary's body, but yet had not taken his life. And now Typhus was preparing to follow the failed crusade back home,
wither the man's hive down around him, and take him away with them, reborn into an endless life of servitude to despair. How repugnant a fate! How bountiful my thirsting mistress's generosity that allowed me to make him mine instead! Truly, I am the instrument of magnificence. My visions showed me the Terminus Est, leading Typhus's fleet out of its anchorage, and we flew like darts to remain ahead of them. We found his doomed preacher before he did, and we went to work. The man had ordered himself into seclusion, you see. He had ordered the reclusium at the summit of his temple to be sealed, with himself and the handful of survivors of his failed crusade inside. He understood he had brought contagion back from the dark places, and he had it in his mind to bow down before the Aquila in prayer until his emperor rewarded his passion by burning the swarm out of his flesh. But his emperor's ears seemed deaf to him, and when the swarm hatched anew, his cries for his gold-enthroned god were drowned out by the cries of his congregation devoured around him. But his true salvation was on its way, by my hand. I brewed a delicious cyca scent that we breathed into the blooms that line the temple roads. Now the fragrance coaxed the pilgrim spirits out of the drab grey rut of the emperor's footsteps. My courtiers sent whispers floating about the penitents so that their scourges and brands inflame their senses rather than punishing them. Emishai no longer strutted, but hunched over and padded about as if creeping among shadows. The clinking of his armoured feet against the flagstones counterpointed the rustle of the bright-coloured rags that dragged from his ankles. A drop of pinkish-white fluid formed in one of the gouges in his tongue, ran down it to the pierced and dangling tip, and splattered to the ground. Oh, none were wise to us, for we were cunning, ghosts wrapped in clever warp-weaves, he went on in the voice of his slave. But the mangy hounds, who heard the cud-chewing imperial mob, could see that mob becoming unruly, and tried to lash and harangue them into renewed obedience. Useless, fruitless, the fire was spreading. We had opened minds, and now we opened bodies, letting the herd see their hounds picked apart and spread out beneath the hot purple-white sun. They began to rejoice as they felt their senses brightening and raced to outdo one another in fresh ways to flood their nerve endings. Now we showed ourselves, my courtiers and I, and danced among them on blood-slick roads as the spires lit up and then burned down around us. Finally, as the very shape of the stones and the colour of the sky began to change, and the breezes and flowers themselves began to dance and sing and murder, Typhus's plague fleet arrived. Here, at the memory of the joke he had played, Amishai was consumed by fits of laughter that doubled him over and shook him to his knees. Both his slaves instantly knelt to mimic him, but Amishai paid them no heed. His mutated larynx gave out squeals so shrill that the blind boy-slave moaned in pain to hear them, and guffawed so deep that for a few moments Chengrel was sure he could feel the inhuman racket buzzing through his life-support syrup and into the remains of his organs. Finally, the fits passed, and the traitor marine collected himself. "When the Terminus Est appeared in the night sky," he said, "it dimmed the stars around it with its presence, its bleak aura glowing like a chilly canker sore over our heads, eating the life out of the space around it to draw the rest of the fleet through. Skeletal hulks, whose crews brooded in decks rotted open and sealed shut again with hull plates flayed from vessels they preyed upon. Drives burning hot like killing fevers. And oh, my brothers and companions, it was a killing fever that came upon Typhus when he saw what had become of his conquest. He led his reeking and downtrodden column down to the Doctrinopolis, where we ran and slit our skins and laughed aloud. He planted his boots on the great road that led to the Doctrinopolis spire and spoke in a voice like a bone rasp that clouded and cracked the road he stood upon, which had been dusty flagstones and was now brightly coloured glass. There was no grandeur to the rage of Typhus. He did not brandish his blade up to the sky or call upon vengeance in a thunderous voice, but in that sick, roughened tone, he demanded who had brought this insult against him. I answered his call. Dancing upon the chiming scented glass of the road in front of him, he hissed his rebukes at me, struck with his blade at me, sent fat and dripping creatures of his swarm through the air to sting and lash at me. I capered away from him, eluding him, drawing him on. As Typhus gave chase, drooling mucus from his armour seams, his host began to make war with us, and failed, for we had made this place so wholly ours that when the thralls of Nurgle tried to mar it, it changed them instead. Our new city brought tingling to their long-dead nerves and thawed the rim off their hearts. The foot soldiers, the ones with no mark from their master, but only the marks of their weary servitude to him, cried and spasmed as our delirium woke their senses in ways they had never known. Typhus had brought demons whose bodies were made from the purest dreams of rot given form in the wellspring. But my own master's host, exquisite beasts and fiends, came to meet them. And when they found that the enemy would not dance with them, they took pity on such creatures as were made unable to feel delight, and unravelled them. As for Typhus himself, vengeance had put blinkers on his eyes, and all he could see was myself, his enemy, dancing ever backwards. Emishai's distended fingers whipped and whistled in the air, sometimes conducting the mad demon chorus that saturated his memories, and sometimes reenacting his duel against the champion of Nurgle. Above him, Chengral's face twisted in distaste, but Hodir, of all the onlookers the most accomplished in bladework, noted what was concealed in the buffoonery of Emishai's movements, the speed and poise, the deft nuances to his parries, the lightning shifts of balance and angle on his riposts. Hodir grew thoughtful, his hand once again drifting to his knife belt. I tempted him and baited him. Oh, and I drew him on into our city. In the great crossroads beneath the cathedral, its buttresses meeting a half mile over our heads, we fenced together. He silent, I laughing my delight as my combat glands flushed ever stranger liqueurs through my veins. Finally, Typhus's rage pushed him into speech. You dare, he demanded of me. This city and this world and all its prizes are mine, in the name of Grandfather beyond the eye. They were mine that they should be his. Who are you to dare denying us what is ours? Have you no concept of what you contend against? Contend? I asked, for this was long ago, and my face and tongue had not yet been remade, as you see them. No contention here, only joy. No words of harsh contumely here, only clear and endless songs of nerves and dreams flayed bare. And I spread my arms wide, inviting Typhus to turn his senses outwards and behold the blessings we had made. But he only saw me as inviting him to assault me anew. Why do you tolerate this treatment from this grandfather of yours? I asked him as we duelled again. Your grandfather, if such you must call him, for surely your Primarch's sire is your grandfather, has laid his reeking cloak upon your body and soul and called it good. Your grandfather's curse is not a plague or rot. It is numbness, sloth, eroding your passions and senses into drab despair or plodding servitude. Who would inflict such a thing on you is not your friend, Master Typhus. Let me show you. Let me turn you outwards again. Exchange your grandfather's sulking stagnation for my mistress's blazing raptures. But Typhus, he would not be swayed. Such was the drought of bitterness that he had swallowed to the dregs so long ago.
Grandfather, he retorted, and swung his scythe with fresh strength and fury. That broken toy in the palace on Terra is no grandfather of mine. His blood was water weak, and his sons took on his weaknesses. Look at you!
And he matched the words to a twist of blade that came exquisitely close to opening me.
They tried to become conquerors, and never understood what conquest truly means. True conquest is not defeat. True conquest is despair to live. I will mortify the desires of my enemies to live, rot their souls into despair, and ride that despair into dominion. But you, you prancing puppet.
And with that, he stepped back, presenting his blade on guard, and looked me up and down.
Fulgrim's little whelps never did understand, for all that they bragged about how they would open the doors of their own minds and understand all. The soil of Chemos grew nothing but popinjays.
At that, I laughed again. Misguidance upon misguidance, I told him, as I watched the little creatures hatching from his hive and swarming into the air, only to scatter senseless about his feet as our perfumes reached them. I am no child of Chemos. Isvan and Talan and Terra and even Lost Scalathrax were memories by the time the Emperor's children called me into their ranks. And conquest? Of what value is conquest? What cares the gleeful mind for conquest when the ecstatic awaits? You think that taking away this grey little missionary's faith has made him another conquest for you? Let me show you what we have proven on him. Let me show you what he is with the chains of mortal senses taken from him. And with that, I sang a command in a voice that shattered all the glass flagstones underneath us. And Typhus looked up to see two raptors from my court's militia carrying their passenger down from the cathedral spire. His hair, which had hung to his waist, had been matted with pus and sweat in his seclusion, had been washed, perfumed and braided, and each braid was knotted about one of the raptor's wrists. Their claws gripped his shoulders. Antiphas beheld that this man, this preacher and crusader, set so high in the ecclesiarchy, was not his prize now, but ours. He saw the marks, heard the delicate warp-keening that reaved the man's twitching body, smelt, even over his own supernatural plague reek, the warp musk that the preacher's flesh had begun to sweat. And he saw what had become of that first infection, the eggs that his swarm had planted, whose blossoming had brought his plans and mine into motion. The destroyer hatchlings in the preacher man's flesh had nearly claimed him for Nurgle's embrace. But we had worked too much of Slaanesh's wiles on him for that to last. In the preacher's body, the Nurgle swarm had transfigured. Clouds of brilliantly hued mites swarmed about his face, so small that they could have been coloured smoke. Spiders pushed their way out through the flesh, and then clung to it with their bright red and gold legs, holding the wound apart so the meat beneath could be stirred by the air. Elegant worms, in magnificent clashing hues, wriggled under his skin and hatched forth to spit sparks and perfume at one another. The preacher's eyes were gone, but his face was pulled in a grin of delight, not a scowl of despair. This final humiliation Typhus could not bear. He hawked a battle curse from his inflamed throat and lunged forwards, intent on wrecking the evidence of his defeat. But the raptors opened the throats of their engines and bore the man away. He roared with his psyker voice, calling the foul breath of his grandfather to wither us, and sent his destroyer swarm to devour the preacher afresh. But our prince's touch was on that place too firmly. His swarm scattered to the ground, insensible and already mutating, and his warp call was choked off as our mistress's song pressed in upon him. I laughed at him, and laughed some more, and he chased me into the middle of my host. There he rasped and roared and laid about him until he began to see the faces of his own soldiers around him. Some were overcome by what we had shown them, dancing in among us. Those who had fought that liberation were paraded in pieces, heads and limbs tossed and juggled and kicked underfoot. And in amongst this I presented myself again, ready to duel Typhus until the duel ended one of us. But Typhus stared at me a long moment, and then in the sickly, unrushing light burst of a teleporter, he was gone. Within the hour, I was to hear the word of my seers that the Terminus Est had left orbit and was forging its way to a jump zone. Where the tiresome brute went after seeing our wonders, I do not know. Emish Oi's words tapered off, and he stood slumped on Chengrel's little stone stage, as though his theatrics had exhausted him. He let his eyes close for a moment, then stalked back towards his seat, head down, yanking hard on the collars of his slaves and making them stumble behind him. He dropped into his seat with a clatter of armour and ornamental fetishes, and sat there silent.
"We thought something from that tale would be your bid here, brother," said Crove, after it became apparent that Emish Oi did not plan to speak further. "You have presented your account, but what is your payment to be? Pardon my impatience, but our host must hear it before I speak."
But they never heard what Emish Oi planned to offer for the stones, for at that moment Chengrel stamped the adamantium feet of his hulk against the flagstones, and thundered the anger that had been building in him while the Slaaneshi had given his account.
"Now!" he roared. "No more! I forbid it! I shall not hear it!"
The hulk's motors groaned as it tilted back and forth, and there was a great crack as one of its rear legs broke a flagstone in two.
"You think this some sort of noble account? You think this is a tale befitting one of the Legionis Astartes? You think this would win anything but my contempt?"
The girl slave had shrunk behind Emish Oi, staring at Chengrel wide-eyed. The boy could not see him but wept quietly at the pain that Chengrel's shouts brought on his hearing.
"No more! No more of this treachery! Count yourselves blessed by your so-called Prince Emish Oi, that I do not crush you upon this spot and have your carcass flung into the corpse marshes. How can you brag of this? Have you any conception of how low you have brought yourself?"
Chengrel's fury had set the scraps of his body to twitching, and his unanchored head had floated through a 50-degree turn. A minute, then another, passed by while he gradually manoeuvred his head around to face the front again. The occasional burbling growl of frustration came through his speakers.
"And so what of the preacher?"
Drachmas asked, turning to Emish Oi while Chengrel was otherwise occupied.
"You have neglected the crucial message of your tale. Which of the powers kept their claim upon him? Or did he return to the shadow of the Aquila, brother?"
Emish Oi did not raise his head, but made a low buzzing with his breath that the boy slave was able to interpret. "It is barely in my memory. The manner in which my court acquired him was the marvel and the story. So what care we for what became of him after that? We may have sold him on some border world in the Wellspring, I think. What of it?" Drachmas was about to reply when Chengrel cut them off again.
"No, be silent. I'll have no more treachery discussed. Speak to him no more, Drachmas, so that his shame does not shame you."
At that, Drachmas rose from his chair, his little familiar keeping its balance on his shoulder with practiced ease.
"My remark was addressed to a fellow master of a fellow legion, sir," he declared. "Your own labours have kept you here in this quieter place for quite a time, Brother Chengrel, and perhaps you have not heard of Emish Oi of the Emperor's Children and his infamous wandering court, the reaving of the fleet of Craftworld Rosheth, the seizing of the Thanemost clock from its Mechanicus keepers, and the holding of it against the vengeance of the Storm Warden Space Marines, the Epidurgic Crusade through the Segmentum Pacificus. I show respect to you as a witness to the Horus heresy and the birth of our long war, but I pay respect to Amish Ai that his service to the fourfold ruin commands." Dragmus's tone made the rebuke in his final words clear, but Changrel paid no heed to it.
"Respect," he boomed. "Of course you show me respect. Am I not mighty? You saw my fortress, you heard the account of my wars, and when you..."
And there Changrel caught himself as something about Drachmus's words struck home.
"Explain to me, Drachmus, word bearer. You said you paid me respect as one who had borne arms while the corpse emperor was still just the false emperor. Explain why you remarked upon it, when it is that war and the hate that burns from it that defines all of us here."
"My memories of Horus's war have been taught to me," Drachmus said, making no attempt to conceal the surprise in his words. "I was born into a people chosen by Lorgar to carry copies of his writing into exile when he could not be sure how far or deep the persecution of his true faith would run. I was born into the 73rd generation, in the 204th year of our exile, after we had been hounded from our homeworld on Calate, 1200 years after the end of the heresy. Omens led us to the word-bearer's barge, and the fleet gave up its young as aspirants in gratitude." Changrel's eyes pulsed and blinked as he pondered this, before he directed his gaze at Hodir.
"You?"
he asked.
"The Tyrann scouring," Hodir answered. "The Night Lords tox bombed the cities, then sabotaged the shelters one by one, so we all had to fight for places in the last one. When there was only one shelter left, they stormed it, took 100 youngsters, and left the rest to choke. I was one of the 100. 37th millennium, Imperial Reckoning."
"And you?"
Changrel snarled at Amish Ai. Without opening his eyes, the latter nudged his boy slave with the side of his foot.
"The lineage of my master, Amish Ai, I shall present for brevity," the slave said. "He knows not where he was born or how. His memories begin in the great cages towed before the procession of the demon prince Avrashil, journeying to war. He remembers a great war and a great dying beneath the gaze of many-armed Fulgrim and being remade by Fabius Manflayer. He was given commission into the Emperor's Children Warband of Chadra Bloodwine in the 8th millennium after the so-called heresy." Once again, there was silence in the little circle of legionaries. Changrel glowered at his guests. Hodir and Crove sat motionless. Drachmus picked up little pinches of ash between his fingers and let them drop back into the bowl, studying the patterns they made in the air as they fell and settled. The glow from them burnished his faceplate, for dusk was falling now, and the meeting place was shrouded in gloom. Amish Ai fidgeted and stroked his lacerated tongue. Finally, Changrel gave another growl through his speakers.
"Crove," he said. "Crove of the Thousand Sons, scion of Magnus, son of... But are you truly a son of Prospero, or are you, like these others, a stripling latecomer? But speak your peace, speak your peace. If your account is glorious, then it may even sweeten my disposition enough to hear the bid from this so-called Emperor's child."
Slow and quiet, Crove walked into the middle of the circle and stood a few moments. Then he let out a cry and smote the flagstones with the heel of his staff, and instantly was wrapped in hissing flames of pink and blue, bright enough that Amish Ai, girl slave, squeezed her eyes shut from the pain of it. Crove struck again, and the flames fell from his body, flowing out to become a billowing ground mist, and lifting Crove into the air on a pedestal of coloured fire. He pointed down with his staff, and wherever he pointed into the roiling colours underneath him, they began to twist and churn. With no preamble other than this extravagant show of sorcery, Crove of the Thousand Sons began his tale. Continues in part 3.